Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is David Robinson, number 46877. I am presenting argument this afternoon on behalf of appellants, specifically McWhinney Holding Company, LLLP, Colorado Limited Liability Limited Partnership, McWhinney Sentara Lifestyle Center, a Colorado LLC, Sentara Lifestyle Center, derivatively and as a nominal defendant, again, a Colorado LLC, Sentara Properties West, a Colorado LLC, SMP4 Investments, Inc., a Colorado corporation, and Sentara Retail Sales Fee Corporation, a Colorado nonprofit corporation. I would request 3 minutes reserved for rebuttal. Thank you. May I please the court? Delaware law applies. Colorado follows the restatement, thus enforces choice of law provisions. Section 187 of the restatement second of conflicts applies, not 188, as cited by appellees. No showing below a fundamental conflict with Colorado public policy was made. No finding to the same was made. Appellees are all Delaware entities, thus domiciliaries. In fact, the entity, the nominal, and incidentally, I just misspoke, Sentara Lifestyle Center LLC is a Delaware LLC. It is also a Delaware domiciliary. Now, as we've pointed out, established Colorado law holds that they hold the burden of proof with respect to waivers. There is one thing that was omitted in our briefs because, quite frankly, we didn't catch it until late. The first time the issue of Delaware law being applied was raised was actually in the original motions in connection with our motion for leave to file the First Amendment complaint.
Where would we find that in the record?
Unfortunately, I was just looking for that at the last minute. I can get you the cite to the motion. The opposition is at page 330. It makes reference to Delaware law where the appellees refer to Delaware law, but there are several pages that I can get you from the other record, and I do apologize not having it immediately at my disposal.
Okay, thank you.
At any rate, that was, of course, the first time that the issue was raised. The omnibus order resolving all of the various motions that had been, if you will, backlogged for months, that omnibus order did not mention the issue of Delaware law. It simply applied Colorado law. Ergo, motion for reconsideration, that was a major issue. The reply was a major issue. The opposition was a major issue. And quite simply, the first sentence of the motion, or the order denying the motion for reconsideration states affirmatively, court considered motion, response, and reply. I think it's difficult, therefore, to conclude that the court did not consider, which is the test for determining whether the issue was considered.
So let me ask you a question about the choice of law provision.
Yes, sir.
It states this agreement and the LLC itself shall be governed by and construed in accordance with the laws of the state of Delaware. And what we're talking about here are tort claims. How would you respond to an argument that the choice of law provision only goes to construing the contract and does not address possible tort claims?
Well, one of the cases we cited, which is a recent case, I believe it was a Target Company, applied Delaware law to all substantive matters in a very similar phrased choice of law provision. But the other point I'd raise more fundamentally is the very issue we're here is because presumably Colorado law is being a contract law or a judge-made doctrine predicated on judge-made law is being used to block the tort claims. So I think for both reasons, that the choice of law provision should warrant a reversal of that order.
Well, Mr. Robinson, let me follow up on your first point there. You were referring to Target Corporation as the case you're relying on as being a similar provision. Now, in Target Corporation, that choice of law provision was drafted, I think, more broadly, correct me if I'm wrong, that it says all matters arising out of or related to the agreement, whereas the language arising out of and related to does not appear in the agreement that we have here. So could you explain to me why it still would follow under that term?
Well, I first of all, I agree with Your Honor's observation. I believe that the notion that the LLC will be governed under Delaware law, the conduct related to the LLC would include, among other things, the torts we're referring to. That having been said, one of the points I'll reach in a moment, some of the torts we contend, at least we contend, were extraneous to the operation of the LLC. And in that regard, if I could just jump to that point, one of the errors that we believe were made below was an assumption that all the tort duties arose out of the breach of contract. Yet the answer filed in this case by appellees, and there are three, there's the one contracting entity, that's PNM, then what we call the parent entity, which is PMLC, and what I also refer to as the sister entity, POKE. PMLC and POKE have stated and affirmatively alleged in their answer that the contracting entity is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent. And that's paragraph 3 of the answer. The POKE, the sister entity, is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent. That's paragraph 4. The parent is not an owner of the sister. That's paragraph 4. The three appellees are and have never been alter egos of each other, that each is a separate and distinct entity with separate owners, separate bank accounts, and separate business purposes. That's paragraph 7. And none of them are jointly liable for the acts of the other. That's also paragraph 7. Now, they've raised that point on several occasions, first to avoid jurisdiction before the American Arbitration Association, which ultimately led to the stipulation and the filing of this action, and then initially before the first assigned bench officer, Judge Field, in arguing that since they were not parties to the operating agreement, they could not possibly have any liability in this action. Of course, Judge Field robustly rejected that by, in her order, pointing out that plaintiffs have asserted claims that implicate a direct liability against PMLC, the parent, and POKE, the sister, for example, breach of fiduciary duties and fraudulent conduct. Now, if you accept their point of view, then their conduct is, in fact, outside of the contract. So there, quite frankly, I think Colorado law probably would apply, to be perfectly honest. The second point, though, that's related to all this, is once Judge Williams succeeded Judge Field as the assigned bench officer in this case, Pelley's abruptly shifted gear and argued the operating agreement shielded them all from liability, including the what they claim are the non-contracting appellees, stating, they conclude, appellants have no remedy whatsoever against them. I would just point out that I don't believe there's ever been a cited case, and we've now had an opportunity to review just about all of them, where the economic loss rule has been used to deprive the wrong party of any remedy. The concept is to avoid overlapping contract and tort liability, but not to avoid contract liability. And I'm sorry that was a more expansive answer to your question, but in that regard, I believe that there is, in fact, a good basis for applying Colorado law if, in fact, they are successful in proving what they have alleged. I will also say that this notion of depriving us of any remedy if you go through the, and I'm sure your daughters have gone through the various cases, there's always been, in my opinion, something of an effort to try to find a contract remedy, even when, for example, in BRW, there was no direct contractual privity. There was nonetheless found to be a contractual remedy. In the very recent case that was filed or submitted to the court earlier this week, Top Rail, again, the contractual remedy for the acts of the agent is found to exist. They're simply saying that their acts have no remedy. And what acts do I refer to? Well, for example, and this is a major issue in the complaint, we asked them when the construction loan went into default whether the parent and the sister had any conflicting relationships or economic ties with the very bank that the LLC was negotiating with in terms of a workout. We wanted to know if they had a recourse obligation, because if they had a recourse obligation, then in our view, the subsidiary, in our view, the contracting entity, would be in a terrible conflict of interest, could not possibly negotiate aggressively a workout, because it would be basically throwing the parent and the sister under the bus. Now, for over 2 years, the parent and the sister robustly maintained, since they were not parties to the LLC, They had no duty whatsoever to provide us that information, nor did they at that time provide us with that information. But they did affirmatively seek to act, and the act was that they lied. They said there was no recourse. Later turned out that there was. When a party voluntarily undertakes to speak, at that point, they have a duty to speak truthfully and completely. And one, obviously too verbose, one major point that I want to make as a policy matter is this court's being asked to decide whether the LLC Act, in my opinion, is trumped by the economic loss rule, an act of the legislature. The LLC Act very clearly states what the default rules will be, and the beauty of an LLC is the parties can change it by way of their agreement. Here, the parties were sophisticated, they did have a domestic counsel, and they did not change it. In fact, they paraphrased it, they redoubled it, and if anything, expanded it. And in addition, what they could have did, and obviously didn't do, was throw in the standard boilerplate provision that there would be a limitation on remedies, or define a remedy, such as occurred in many of the other economic loss rule cases. They did not do so, nor did they put any limit on punitive damage recovery. Yet, now paradoxically, the economic loss rule is being asserted to thwart that very expressed intention. It doesn't make any sense. In fact, I would say that the judgment doctrine, the economic loss rule, should not be applied to thwart the structure of the LLC Act, which has been robustly in effect in the state since 1990. In fact, Colorado was the third state to adopt it very successfully. It doesn't make any sense that it should be used to thwart the very purpose of the Act. And one other court that we have seen has effectively faced this conundrum, this conflict, and that's the case that we cited in the reply brief, the Blue Earth Biofuels case, 780 Fed Sub 2nd, 1061, that's the Hawaii case, where there the court said, well, obviously, there is a pre-existing duty. It does not, it's one based on the statute. It does not make sense to apply this judicial doctrine to thwart that statute. And because I'm really down to the nub, I'm going to have to abandon most of my comments and just point out that the Delaware law provides what amounts to a flowing only from the contract test. That's Israel. Flowing only from the contract. I think the most recent enunciation of this in Colorado, the Gaddis case, has the obverse of that, and it makes sense. It takes some time to digest, but that the tort claim could not have been proven without first proving the defendants also breached their contract. I think that's the obverse of the flowing only from the contract test. Yet, I think there is a diversion or an outlier to that. The Mikado case took the position that the economic loss rule bars tort activity where the tort proves a breach of contract. That's an entirely different test. And of course, in the Mikado case, it was the failure to deliver something that wasn't deliverable, a patent that had already lapsed. And the court found that, well, that can't be theft without being a breach of contract. But conceptually, that is a completely different test because the duty may spring from an independent source, in this case the statute, but the breach of the tort duty also proves a breach of contract. That's not the point. In fact, if that were the point, the myriad of Colorado cases finding the economic loss rule does not apply could not exist in that same universe with the Mikado test. Yet it was the Mikado test that the trial court applied. See if there's something.
Well, Mr. Robinson, you have a little over a minute left.
Thank you very much. I'd like to say that there are four distinguishing factors between this case and Hammond. First, the enforcement of an LLC operating agreement there was not at stake, nor was the statutory scheme of the LLC Act. The contract in Hammond did provide for an extensive pre-negotiated remedy. Finally, the torts were all committed by the contracting defendant or its admitted agents. All the various cases cite the same concept. Brasby, a case that the appellees cite, for example, not only found that that was the case, but they allowed the fraud claim against the agent to proceed, an important thing not to overlook. And there was no suggestion that the city or its agent were fiduciaries, which I think is a major point. And I believe that both Colorado and Delaware holds that where fiduciary duty exists, the economic loss rule does not apply, And I think that makes nothing but common sense, because otherwise one would be inviting people to escape fiduciary duty even when they contract for it. It just doesn't make sense.
All right. Thank you. Thank Your you time is much. Up.
It pleases the court and counsel. I am Jennifer Lynn Peters. I'm here at registration number 31699, Colorado registration number 31699. I am here today on behalf of the defendants, Pogan McEwen Lifestyle Center Centerra, which was the managing member of the Centerra Lifestyle Centers LLC, Pogan McEwen Lifestyle Centers, its parent company, and Pogue Lifestyle Centers, an entity formed well after the foreclosure occurred in this case, and sort of got caught up in this because it is now the manager by contract with the current owner of the property. I want to correct right off the bat something that Mr. Robinson just said. He made the statement that when there is a fiduciary relationship, that Colorado and Delaware law both say that the economic loss rule does not apply. We disagree with that. In particular, in Colorado, in the case of a good time rental, the court considered whether a fiduciary relationship was sufficient enough to create and implicate what they refer to as the special relationship exception to the economic loss rule, and specifically concluded that just because there's a fiduciary relationship does not mean the economic loss rule does not apply.
The court used language like not necessarily, isn't that correct?
Correct, not necessarily, so. But it means it's not a bright line rule the way Mr. Robinson has said it. And I think a good time rental is instructive because it walks through when an exception is made based on the relationship between the parties. And when those exceptions occur, it's because there's a lack of bargaining power. There's a homeowner trying to sue a national home builder. There's an insured trying to sue an insurance company. There's those types of cases where the one party clearly has unequal bargaining power and may not be as sophisticated as the other party to the contract. Those are instances where a consumer is trying to it needs protection in the law to protect its personal, their property interest or some other interest to avoid physical harm that isn't present in this case.
Let me ask you this: as I understand it, your position is that the other entities, Pogue and PMLC, are not parties to the contract. Not alter egos and so on of the principal defendant, and therefore there's no contract remedy against them, and the trial court seems to have extended the economic loss ruling and ruling on the motion to dismiss to determine that the tort claims against them were also not viable. That seems strange to me that that combination results in essentially an immunity of those parties to all the claims. Can you explain that?
What I would start with is, I think Pogan McEwen Lifestyle Centers, the parent company, did sign the operating agreement with regard to a couple of provisions. So in some extent, it is a contracting party and therefore would be bound by the good faith and fair dealing requirement. And Pogan McEwen Lifestyle Centers and Pogan McEwen Lifestyle Center Centerra, often referred to as PNM in the briefing, the managing entity, are interrelated companies, just like the companies were in the BRW case. And so it's our position that the extension of the economic loss doctrine to, in particular, PMLC, was appropriate here because BRW recognized that where you have two sophisticated parties in a complex commercial transaction, such as we had here, and they enter into an agreement that's heavily negotiated where both sides are represented with equal bargaining power, and all of the contracts are interrelated with each other, and you contemplate there'll be interrelated relationships as this operating agreement clearly did, it's appropriate to extend it to those related but not necessarily parties to the contract. Now, Pogue Lifestyle Center is a little different because we agree. Pogue Lifestyle Center has no liability under this operating agreement. It didn't even exist at the time it was created. But the court's dismissal of the tort claims against it was appropriate nonetheless because there are no allegations against Pogue Lifestyle Centers other than the conclusory statement that it's an alter ego. And if that statement is true, which we dispute, then it would be liable under the contract theory. If it's not true, There, and then we would ask you to look through the complaint. There are no allegations of fact against Pogue Lifestyle Centers that would support any liability. The complaint in beginning, and I'm afraid I don't have the paragraph cite for you off the top of my head, the complaint starts with, below are our factual allegations related to PMLC and PNM's alleged breaches of contract and fiduciary duty. And then it follows for almost 100 paragraphs. The only time they reference Pogue Lifestyle Centers is in the conspiracy claim, where they again make a conclusory allegation that it was part of a conspiracy to breach the contracts. But that's it. There's no other allegations that support the dismissal or just support imposing any kind of duty or that there even was a duty by Pogue Lifestyle Centers during the time these transactions took place.
Are there breach of contract claims asserted against PMLC and Pogue?
Well, it depends on how you read their complaint. The complaint asserts breach of contract claims against defendants. But it's our position that when you read the body of the complaint as a whole, and it's a lengthy one, their allegations center only on PMLC and PNM, not Pogue.
Okay, I think that gets back to my questions. Why you would get a determination that the tort claims should be obviated when there isn't even a contract claim available or at least asserted against them?
Well, what I would say is, one, I don't think and maybe I'm not being as clear on that point, to the extent the court was wrong to apply the economic loss doctrine to Pogue, its dismissal was nevertheless appropriate because they haven't stated a claim against Pogue Lifestyle Centers. I also think under the doctrine set forth in BRW and discussed further in a Good Time Rental and Top Rail Ranch, the overriding policy considerations here, that when you have two sophisticated parties in a construction development contract situation like we have here, where there are an operating agreement that's almost 50 pages, several development agreements, a management agreement, and knowledge that what we really have here is an agreement between McWinney and the Pogues for a joint venture to develop the Promenade Shops in Satara. And they knew they were doing that with a series of interrelated contracts, and they knew in the operating agreement, I believe it's in section 8.1 and 8.3, they knew there could be a pledge of an interest, there could be assignments by and among related parties owned by McWinney on one side and the Pogues on the other during the course of these transactions. So BRW in particular holds that when there is an interrelated arrangement such as this and such a complex arrangement that these sophisticated parties entered into, the law should step in to say they both knew what they were getting into. They both had the opportunity to contract for all of their issues and rights and did so. And to the extent that they now want to try to duplicate claims to assert a tort claim, which is really what they've done here, they have not asserted separate allegations against any of these other defendants. They've duplicated their contract claims as tort claims. All of the same facts support both claims.
Okay, let me just ask you very briefly about, I think it's section 16.6, which allows claims against other members for actions or omissions involving actual fraud, gross negligence, or willful misconduct. What's the effect of that? Isn't that essentially recognizing that those kinds of tort claims are preserved and recognized?
I don't think it preserves it. I think what it does is limits the liability. What section 6.6 in the contract says,
6.6, excuse me,
is that the members shall exercise, and the manager, their best efforts, owe a duty of good faith and fair dealing, and shall not be liable for actions taken in good faith that they reasonably believe are in good faith. That sets the standard of care for the members and the manager. It then goes on to say, but we recognize a member shall be liable to and shall indemnify another member for actions involving actual fraud, gross negligence, or willful conduct. To me, that's the party saying, okay, we have set our standard of care. If during the performance of this agreement we commit actual fraud or gross negligence, we agree under the contract we're liable for that. It's subsuming those tort duties and only those tort duties within the contract. So now we're in a situation like Mikado where the specific tort duty is no longer independent of the contract. It's subsumed within it and contemplated by it. And that provision with regard to indemnification in particular talks about the fact that what they're doing here is saying, I will indemnify you if for some reason the company gets sued for fraud, negligence, or otherwise. And if I do it, then that's something we bargained for. You see, that creates a breach of contract.
But the language says a member shall be liable to other members and so on.
Correct, but it's...
Not simply by way of indemnification.
Yes, but what it's doing is saying, under the terms of our agreement where we've limited, here's what our duties are. I am liable for breaching those duties, and I also agree to be liable if I commit an act that qualifies as actual fraud or gross negligence or willful conduct. In those circumstances, what the parties are doing is saying, I agree under contract I'll be liable for that. They're not saying, I agree you may sue me under the contract and in tort. What they're trying to do is encompass all of those claims within the scope of their contract, and that's what they did by this provision. Now, there's a policy consideration here that Mr. Robinson touched on briefly about whether or not the economic loss rule should apply generally to operating agreements. To us, we think that is an easy decision. Obviously, an operating agreement is a contract, and it should be subject to the economic loss rule. We believe the policy, whether you're looking at Delaware or Colorado, is clear that the LLC formation and the statutes applying them, both states of which allow an entity, the parties creating an entity, to eliminate fiduciary duties, to limit their duties so long as they're manifestly reasonable and don't eliminate the duty of good faith. The flexibility the LLC acts provide and the freedom of contract that Colorado's recognized in Weinstein and that the Delaware courts have recognized in cases like Bay Center shows that the economic loss rule is meant to apply to an operating agreement, probably more so than any other type of contract, because these operating agreements are typically entered into by two sophisticated parties in a complex commercial transaction where each have equal bargaining power. So I would invite this court to take this opportunity to make a clear statement that the economic loss rule does apply to LLC operating agreements and to follow the policy that has been handed down in several cases that precede us here, such as BRW, A Good Time Rental, Weinstein, and Top Grill Ranch. The second issue before you that I'm not sure has really been touched upon here is the denial of the motion to amend the complaint. So I'd just like to take a few minutes to just address that issue, because to me that presents a slightly harder question for this court. In the what we refer to as the quiet title or the use restriction case between these parties and one of the tenants in the shopping center, the plaintiffs sought to quiet title and obtain a declaratory judgment that a use restriction in one of the leases did not apply. In their complaint, they specifically sought relief for that use restriction, not only in the form of the declaratory judgment, but in an award of attorney's fees and costs related to under contract, statute, or other applicable law. What they seek to do now by adding an indemnification claim in their amended complaint is to rebring and relitigate that issue of an award of costs and fees in that case. There was no reason to have my clients as defendants in that lawsuit, but for the request for fees and costs. And that request for fees and costs was actually litigated in that case. The court denied the request for fees in its ruling, findings of facts and ruling, and it granted the request for costs, admittedly reduced it significantly, but granted the costs. And so what we have here is an attempt to relitigate the same issues that have already been tried. Now, the plaintiffs have argued that there's no identity of parties between the two cases. And we submit that's not the case because they're all McWinney-owned and related. But to the extent that's true, then the plaintiffs in this case do not have standing. They do not have an injury for which they're entitled to seek indemnification because then they didn't incur costs and fees in the use restriction case. I would also mention that preclusion is particularly important in this instance because this use restriction issue that went all the way through trial is unrelated to any of the claims that have been made in this case. It would require essentially a trial within a trial on issues that have already been heard by the court. And that is the reason that we have rules like issue and claim preclusion to step in and say you don't get to relitigate. So we would ask the court to affirm the denial of the motion to amend. Lastly, I would just like to point out for this court and ask you to look at the opportunity you have before you. I believe it's a natural extension of this economic loss rule in the LLC context between sophisticated parties to a complex commercial transaction, that really any tort duty that could arise really is subsumed within the duty of good faith and fair dealing that cannot be contracted around. And I think this court has an opportunity here in this case to make a bright line rule that in cases between sophisticated commercial parties, where, such as we have here, that there will never be a tort claim available because the good duty of good faith and fair dealing subsumes it all. And we would ask you to so affirm the court's orders.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will now stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.